I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver. This is thecommentary.ca. Camilla Gibb has long been one of Canada's most fascinating of literary talents. Her new book has been one of the most eagerly awaited Canadian books of the season, and she's in Vancouver now to talk about it, being a new mom, and more. The book is called The Beauty of Humanity Movement. It is a novel set in Vietnam. It is described as a book that speaks about the reverberation of conflict through generations, art, love, and more, all amidst the backdrop of Vietnam and its history. Camilla Gibb has a PhD in social anthropology from Oxford. She was born in London but grew up in Toronto. Her previous book, Sweetness in the Belly, was a bestseller and a Giller Prize finalist. She's critically acclaimed and popular worldwide. Her website is at camillagibb.com. The book is published by Doubleday. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Camilla Gibb. Good morning, Ms. Gibb.
Good morning, Joe. How are you?
Very well, yourself.
Good, thanks.
Is it Dr. Gibb? Do you use that?
No, I don't use it. I mean, technically, I suppose that's correct, but it really only applies in an academic setting, which I've abandoned.
Yeah, how long ago did you abandon that?
It was 2000, actually. So it's been 10 years now that I've sort of immersed myself in a writing life. I took the plunge. I guess after my first novel was written and I realized that that was my kind of natural language and I wanted to write more.
And 10 years ago, was that when you thought that you could make a living out of this?
Well, it took, yeah, I mean, my first book was published by a tiny press in Canada, a wonderful tiny press, but it only earned me a $400 advance, so I didn't think that was terribly realistic in the moment, but it then got picked up by Random House in the UK, who sold the world rights. So I was in a position where there was a bit more income attached, and I thought, okay, this is my moment. Even though I'd spent, you know, the previous 10 years kind of invested in an education that was leading me towards an academic job, so it was a tough decision to make, but it just felt really vital and necessary.
And did you always want to be a writer? Like, say, when you were a kid, did you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's probably true of most writers. I think I wanted to be a poet. I think I announced that I would be a poet when I was about 6 years old. Except then I went to the ROM and saw the dinosaurs, the Royal Ontario Museum. Saw the dinosaur exhibit and then learned the word paleontologist. So for a while I was going to be a paleontologist. But I started by copying other people's poetry. I remember copying a book from When We Were Six, A.A. Milne's collection, called, I don't even remember the title, but it started When I Was a Bird and Flew on High. Anyway, I copied this poem out verbatim and showed my mother, and she thought it was absolutely brilliant, but I couldn't confess that I'd plagiarized it.
Yeah, they say that in journalism school you should get some of the best writing, you know, like Hemingway, say, and type that out. That way you get a feel for it.
Yeah, no, I've heard that too. And I probably, when I first started, I probably was thinking along the lines of, you know, I mean, when I say when I first started, when I kind of recommitted myself to it in my 20s, I probably was emulating writers I admired, you know, and some of it coming across as really pretentious, I guess, until I could find my own voice somewhere within that. But even my first novel was written on the heels of reading a book that I thought, oh, that's how you do it. And it was partly an issue of voice, but it was also partly an issue of structure. I'd read Kate Atkinson's Behind the Scenes at the Museum, and she was funny about dark things. And I thought, oh, it's possible to be funny about dark things. And so that's really where I started with my first novel.
No, I just got the book, say, 2 days ago. So I haven't read the book, but I've read about it, and I can't wait to read it because of Pho. I guess it's pronounced Pho, right?
Yeah, it's pronounced Pho, but we more commonly know it as Pho, so I tend to refer to it as Pho.
Yeah. One of the characters in the book sells Pho out on the streets of Hanoi, right?
Yeah, he pushes a sort of a rickety old cart throughout the streets. He's an old man by this point, by the time the book opens. And he's been doing this for, I don't know, something like 30 years, and setting up his stall in a new location every day. And word just travels, people, by word of mouth throughout the old quarter, and people gather. This kind of loyal contingency that's followed him for 30 years gathers for breakfast every morning.
You spent some time in Vietnam, I guess, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's quite common there, right? I was in the Philippines, and people selling food off of a cart.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
And I mean, especially if they don't have a license to operate a business, and still in Vietnam, things are very prescriptive, and, you know, there must be a license for everything. And he, you know, in this case, the character's getting, he's constantly getting fined, which he can't afford to pay. And so, he, you know, he kind of takes off when he sees the police coming, and so do his customers. They all bring their bowls and spoons actually from home because he doesn't have the space to provide them with those. So they bring those from home, and they take off whenever they see the police coming. So, yeah, it's very common to have a street cart. And I don't know, I think it was inspired for me by when on one of my visits to Vietnam, somebody told me that the best pho you could find was on the cart of this very specific man. And we tried to find this man and couldn't because this guy who told me about him wasn't plugged into that network. And so I was so kind of intrigued by the fact that he made the best pho in Hanoi that yeah. I wanted to go home and write his story, which is kind of what happened. I came back to Canada and I just started writing him into being and wondering, well, if he's seen, you know, 87 years of Vietnamese history, he's lived through, what has he been exposed to in his lifetime? And he's the one who kind of led me back through some of the chapters of Vietnamese history.
So back to Pho, fascinated me when I was reading about you, and there's a couple of articles about you that appeared in one of the papers, or a couple of the papers, I guess, and you were posed in front of a bowl.
Yeah.
How often do you eat it?
Probably once a week, and that probably started when I was an undergraduate. I was an undergraduate at the University of Toronto, and Spadina Avenue is not far away, and it was certainly one of the cheapest and most cheerful bowls of anything you could eat as a student, and so at that point it was probably twice a week.
Yeah, I mean, I have it maybe once every couple of weeks, maybe once a month.
Yeah.
And it's just, like, I've always liked it. And I've never thought about it until I read about the book and read about you.
And how symbolic it is. I mean, it's how much is invested in this bowl. There's such fierce national pride about this soup.
Yeah.
Which has interesting origins and has become sort of emblematic. It represents the country. It represents the start to every day. It's really a breakfast food in Vietnam. We tend to eat it for lunch or dinner, but you would eat it sort of first thing in the morning before you went to work or school, and you'd probably eat it on the street on a little plastic chair with a bowl perched on your knees.
Yeah. Is it different in Vietnam than it is in say, Toronto?
The taste of it?
Yeah, the taste of it.
Well, there tends to be regional variation, and so the northern pho is much more austere in some ways. It's blander. They feel it's pure. The North Vietnamese would consider it a much purer bowl. They think that, you know, when people moved south, there was a lot of Chinese influence in the south, and so the taste of the broth has been influenced by Chinese spices. I tend to actually prefer the taste of a southern pho. I think that's maybe my foreign palate. It's not as, the northern pho, again, is not as adorned with green garnish, and, you know, they don't give you hoisin to put in to flavor the meat or the broth. And there are very few northern restaurants in North America because most people who came to North America came from the south. So most of the pho we know is southern pho. But I've sought out quite deliberately the northern restaurants that there are, and there's one a block away from where I live. There's a kind of another mini Chinatown. It's more a Vietnam town at Girard and Broadview in Toronto.
And it's not something that one tries to make at home, right?
Well, I mean, you could, but it would be kind of more of a one-off.
Yeah.
Most people in Vietnam feel like it's way too hot working in a cramped kitchen, and it's way too labor-intensive. You've got to boil that broth for hours, you know, and kind of religiously skim the scum off the surface, you know, that arises from boiling the bones. And it's really labor-intensive, and so why bother? You have these wonderful stalls and shops that are dedicated exclusively to serving you breakfast, and it's really affordable. It's probably about 70 cents a bowl in Vietnam.
There's another character in the book, Maggie.
Yeah.
What's she like?
Maggie's, you know, a sort of interesting outsider, insider, wherever she is. She's Vietnamese-American. She came with her mother from the South, actually. They were living in Saigon with her father. She was only 5 years old. And, of course, 75 is the year that Saigon falls to the North, or is liberated by the North, depending on your perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And so is then under the umbrella of communism, and you see a mass exodus of largely South Vietnamese from the country. In Maggie's case, she, at 5 years old, with her mother, they board a plane that's actually taking a lot of orphans out and to the U.S., and they are resettled in Minneapolis. They've actually just sent the women and children on ahead, so her father remains there on the airfield, and with the promise that he's following on another flight, but he never comes. And so this is a central kind of piece for her that's missing throughout her life, was what has happened to her father. He's an older man, and he's had a very interesting history himself. He was an artist in the North, and he was imprisoned for some of the work he did in the North. And so part of her return to Vietnam in 2007, when she's by this point in her mid-30s, and she's an art curator working in the U.S., she gets a job, a really quite an interesting job, at a hotel in Hanoi, a hotel where a lot of art was kept during the American War in a bomb shelter. And it's never been cataloged. They don't even know what they've got there. So there's kind of this treasure trove of art from, you know, earlier decades that she's now responsible for cataloging and possibly curating. But, of course, she's got very personal reasons for being in Hanoi as well, which is this search for her father. And this is where the lives of the characters begin to intersect. She meets Old Man Hung. She is directed to this old faux seller because he once had his own shop where a lot of artists used to gather in the 1950s. There's this possibility that he might have known her father, which is what brings them into each other's lives.
The art that's in that hotel, is it Vietnamese art?
Yes, it's exclusively Vietnamese art.
Yeah, but we're not familiar with it, I guess, like, say, Chinese art or Japanese art.
No,
is it?
But a lot of because the French influence was so strong,
yeah.
You know, I mean, the French were there until they were ousted in 1954. They were there for almost 80 years, and there was a very famous institute of Indo-Chinese arts based in Hanoi, and generations of Vietnamese artists were trained in the French tradition, and so a lot of stuff that would be very recognizable to us stylistically was being produced. And then, of course, when the communist government, the sort of stronger and more present and then kind of official the communist government became, the more this art was denounced as bourgeois, as foreign-influenced, as, you know, indulgent, narcissistic, as not... More and more the pressure was on these artists to produce communist propaganda. And those who didn't were considered dissident. Those who didn't were considered traitors. And they were punished. You know, they were either coerced into producing art for the communist cause, specifically like posters that were educational that could be then, you know, plastered around the countryside to bring on board the people who were less literate. If they refused to participate, they were often sent to re-education camps. You know, and re-education... It's probably a very tame description for what is effectively, you know, the breaking down of someone,
yeah.
The torturing of someone in order to convince them that they better toe the party line. And a lot of these artists lost their lives.
Now, I read somewhere when you were a few years ago, a benefactor had given you $6,000 so that you could pursue your writing career, right?
Yeah.
Now, when you were in Vietnam, I heard on an interview that you gave someone else, that you had done the same to someone?
Yeah. It was an instance of being able to pay it forward, something I'd wanted to do for years.
Yeah.
So in the initial encounter, it was before I'd written my first novel, and I had just finished my PhD, and I knew that what I was expected to do and what I wanted to do were so far apart, and I didn't know how on earth I would ever, I don't know, probably be happy, be myself. And, which I thought was only going to happen through writing fiction. And
mm-hmm.
I met this friend, well, a colleague, an acquaintance, really. And it's too long a story to recount for you, but he really did, he basically said to me, why are you so unhappy? And when I said that I wanted to write fiction, he said, I don't understand what's standing in your way. And I said, I think part of the considerations are practical, like it's an issue of time and money.
Right.
And he was able to give me $6,000 to buy me 6 months of time to see if I could actually could write. I didn't know if I applied it, you know, did it in a sort of sustained way, whether I could produce anything and whether anything I produced would be publishable. But out of that experience did come my first novel, which was a remarkable thing. And I've always felt that, you know, I would repay this in some way. I just didn't know what that would look like, who it would go to, whether that would be to another young writer, or just simply to someone who had a, you know, a dream that seemed elusive. And in this case, I met this young tour guide in Hanoi who was really impressive, just a very sophisticated and thoughtful young man. And when I asked him whether being a tour guide was his dream, he said, you know, it's not. I mean, it's a good job, but what I would really, really like to do is have my own pho restaurant where I served a Vietnamese clientele using some of the standards that I've acquired working in the service of foreigners. His kind of bottom line being, why don't we treat our own people as well as we treat the guests who come to our country?
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about this at some length, and he actually thought it through to the point of having, you know, sort of mapped out what it would cost to do. And I thought, this is the person who will get that $6,000.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not an investor. I gave it to him with the same kind of faith that it was given to me, you know, with no strings attached. And he's managed to do it. He managed by the end of that year to open a shop, and now he's opening a second restaurant.
Really?
Yeah.
It's a fascinating story.
Well, it kind of makes the world this nice and beautiful small place.
It is, yeah.
Somehow.
It does, yeah.
Yeah.
The book is out now in Canada and has been out for some weeks. In the spring, it'll be released in the United States and Britain. Do you expect a different reaction from those markets, say?
I don't know, really. I mean, I guess I was a bit wary about creating a Vietnamese-American character, only because it remains in the U.S. kind of psyche and imagination such a... Anything to do with Vietnam is such a, well, often such a heavy and weighted and disillusioning kind of, oh, I don't know what the word is for it, but I just had a baby, forgive me, baby brain.
Yeah.
It means something else in the U.S.,
yeah.
I think, anything to do with Vietnam. We tend in Canada to have a kind of a proud feeling about the home we provided to conscientious objectors, the fact that we weren't participants in the war. So our sense of the war is quite different. Of course, this isn't a book about the war. I mean, that's partly what I wanted to do, was tell a story that's had very little to do with the war, because I think it's a North American preoccupation and not a Vietnamese preoccupation. And I wanted to, whatever extent it was possible, tell a Vietnamese story. So it really kind of remains to be seen. The UK market, I wouldn't anticipate, would treat it any differently from the way we've received it here. But I will be very interested to see what happens with it in the U.S. I was on a panel here at the Vancouver Writers Festival about Vietnam a couple of nights ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say the emphasis was much more on the politics of Vietnam. The emphasis was more on the war that the Vietnamese call the American War. And on the French before that. And my book isn't really about the politics of the time in some ways. In some ways it's about people. It's character driven. I know my characters intimately well, even if I don't know Vietnam to the same degree as I know my characters. I know what's universal about them, you know. I know them as people. I feel they are so real. I like to think of them carrying on with their lives in Hanoi.
We've actually, you just mentioned the baby.
Mm.
How old's the baby now?
5 weeks.
Wow.
We've been on tour since week three.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she's a mighty traveler.
Yeah. has the writing stopped as a result?
Yes, the writing has stopped because I have just given myself permission to have a mat leave of sorts.
Yeah.
I've kind of given myself permission until the new year, and then we'll see what happens. And I, you know, expect. It's a different role for me in life and in the world, and I have no doubt it will impact upon what I write in future. It'll be interesting to see.
Now, you'll probably introduce reading to it early on?
Yes. Well, you know, I didn't have any books with me, and then I was on a panel in Calgary with Dionne Brand, and she was reading from her recent poetry collection, Ossuaries, and I thought, oh, and she blew my mind. I love her work. And so I thought, well, I have to have a copy of that. So I've been reading Ossuaries to the baby.
Well, will you introduce it to writing?
I would think so. I would do probably what my mother did with me. You know, my mother raised a reader, and I would like to raise a reader. And one of the things I did was when I had a baby shower, and I asked everybody to bring a book that had either meant something to them as a child or one that they had read to their own children. And so she already has a little library kind of waiting for her. And you know, my mother raised a reader by teaching me my ABCs when I was very small, and then leading me through her bookshelves over the years, you know, by saying, I would stand in front of her bookshelves and say, what's suitable for children? Because this is what she'd say, not suitable for children.
Yeah.
Through reading, I became a writer. I can't say what the moment was or how that took place, because it was so, as soon as I could read, I was writing, you know.
I understand that you're writing a book on motherhood?
Well, I'm thinking about writing a book on, it's a little broader than motherhood. My background is as an anthropologist,
yeah.
And I'm interested in the ways, what parenting looks like and what childhood looks like, you know, cross-culturally. And I want to explore that idea somehow. And it's a bit vague at the moment, but this is in the middle of the night with the midnight feedings. This is what I'm sort of jotting down in my notebook, our thoughts about parenthood and what it looks like around the world.
Camilla, I've enjoyed the conversation today. I can't wait to read the book. Congratulations on the baby, first and foremost.
Thanks so much, Joe. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. The website's for more, CamillaGibb.com. The book is called The Beauty of Humanity Movement. It's published by Doubleday. Its author, Camilla Gibb, on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.